Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Kyle Doherty. In today's episode, we spoke with Jacob Sands, MD. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Sands discussed the rapidly evolving treatment landscape for small cell lung cancer, emphasizing both the progress made with immunotherapy and the ongoing challenges associated with this aggressive disease. A major focus of the discussion centered on tarlatamab, the DLL3-targeting bispecific T-cell engager approved for relapsed small cell lung cancer. The conversation also explored the growing role of molecular subtyping in small cell lung cancer, including emerging data involving ASCL1, NeuroD1, and POU2F3 transcription factor subsets. Sands also addressed real-world experience with tarlatamab, including higher observed rates of cytokine release syndrome and neurologic toxicities among patients who would have not qualified for clinical trials. Finally, the discussion covered recent updates to National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines, including the establishment of tarlatamab as a preferred second-line standard of care regardless of chemotherapy-free interval.
You published across the full spectrum of small cell lung cancer from translational science to real-world outcomes to national guidelines. If you had to summarize where we are in a small cell right now in one sentence or like one blurb here, what would it be?
So to summarize where we are with small cell lung cancer, it's hard to make just one statement on this. And this is a reflection of so many different studies that have come forward. On the one hand, we've seen amazing long-term outcomes, maybe some individuals cured of their incurable disease with the checkpoint inhibitors. It's a subset, but I have people more than 7 years from when they started therapy, now years from their last treatment, still ongoing with scans, looking good. At the same time, there are certainly some patients where the treatment, the first-line treatment worked minimally, other cytotoxics not effective. Now, for some of those individuals, tarlatamab has been amazing, but doesn't work on everybody. And so we see this very wide spectrum of a very aggressive disease that can be very hard to control with short order mortality. And on the other end of the spectrum, people going for years and living their lives without substantial toxicities. Some highlights in there. The PD-L1 inhibitors have been amazing for a subset of patients. Durvalumab, atezolizumab, both approved in the metastatic setting. Durvalumab approved and shows impressive results also in the limited stage setting after chemo radiation. If I can put in a quick plug, I also am a co-PI with Jeff Yang, a thoracic surgeon at MGH, and we're co-leading an adjuvant small cell trial, so post-resection, T12N01, so hyalur nodes allowed, where patients are single arm platinum etoposide and durvalumab. So who knows, maybe from that we'll see data that would also justify this in the adjuvant setting. But right now, a limited stage post chemo radiation and then metastatic setting, really important drug because we see such amazing results for a subset. Tarlatamab is a drug where we've seen incredible results and real durability. Now, I don't know if we're going to see the 7 years durability that I've described that we're seeing with checkpoint inhibitors, but we do see a higher response rate as a single agent therapy, and a good portion of patients with ongoing disease control beyond a year, some beyond 2 years. So this kind of durability, this is a new paradigm drug within the armamentarium of small cell lung cancer therapies. But then, you know, we also have in the background that there's a decent percentage of patients that are still getting minimal benefit from so many of these drugs. And so it's a wide spectrum right now of possibilities, which frankly is a huge improvement from 7-10 years ago.
Can you walk us through what made DLL3 an attractive target in the first place and why it took so long to get to where we are today?
So tarlatamab is a bispecific T-cell engager. It grabs CD3 on T-cells and then DLL3 on the tumor cells, creating an immune response. This drug, I mean, before talking about DLL3, tarlatamab is essentially the drug. It is the only drug that has demonstrated superiority over other drugs in efficacy. This is Delphi 304, randomized second-line trial of tarlatamab versus chemotherapy, is the only positive trial in small cell lung cancer in the second line setting with a therapeutic control arm. And in fact, the only other randomized trial that's positive was topotecan PO versus best supportive care. Even topotecan IV got approved on a trial where it had curves that completely overlap with CAV. So tarlatamab was positive in the second line setting in progression-free survival, in overall survival, in toxicity profile, and in symptom improvement. It is an across-the-board sweep in a setting where we've never seen a positive trial like that. So with that, it's a natural question then is, well, what is DLL3 and why did it take us so long to identify DLL3 and target it with something effective? Now, DLL3 was first identified by the team, or at least first targeted by the team that developed a drug called Rova-T. This was an antibody drug conjugate with the antibody to DLL3, then had a cytotoxic payload. And there was a lot of promise and enthusiasm about this drug. It's a drug that early on had an efficacy signal that was intriguing. In a way, we are targeting something that previously we couldn't target in a way. All of our other therapies were broad treatments. And so this was very exciting. Now, unfortunately, Rova-T ended up really being toxic and ultimately didn't have the efficacy signal that we'd hoped for when in a randomized trial. But I think what it did is lay the groundwork in demonstrating DLL3 as a legitimate targetable antigen on small cell lung cancer. And we now have an array of DLL3 directed therapies. Tarlatamab is the first approved within the T cell engagers, but there are others. And I fully expect that there will ultimately be others approved as well. We have DLL3 antibody drug conjugate now that's showing results far more impressive than what we saw from Rova-T. Those are still early in trials, but DLL3 is very clearly a target. And we're finding multiple ways now to target it.
Your research has shown that ASCL1-driven tumors respond well to the agent, while POU2F3 tumors appear uniformly resistant, and that tumors can actually shift their transcription factor identity as a mechanism of acquired resistance. How should clinicians be thinking about molecular subtyping today? And do you believe that transcription factor profiling should ultimately replace DLL3 expression as our primary biomarker for patient selection here?
I especially appreciate this question about ASCL1 and POW2F3 and the impact in outcomes with the treatment of tarlatamab. And I think this question is likely in reference to a preprint that we released. And I have to say, this is a lot of work that's really led by Matt Friedman's lab and the blood-based testing, and Matt Oser in doing some of the work in mice and looking at these two, the results in humans and the results in mice, to try and learn more about that. And collaborating with them is really some of the most fun I'm having in my academic work. The data released in that preprint essentially outlines that within our cohort of patients, that ASCL1 subtype outcomes look particularly good. Now, we also see some durability in outcomes with NeuroD1 in the baseline tumor. There's a little bit of a difference when we see subtype switching and some of the plasticity that's outlined within that paper, as well as DLL3 expression that is very, very common at the beginning of treatment, but can be lost as a potential resistance mechanism with tumors as well. And in there, there's also some about the tumor microenvironment and increased Tregs and T cell exhaustion as other potential reasons for development of resistance. Now, I need to outline that within that, the POW2F3 subtype, this was only 4 patients within our cohort, but the outcomes really looked particularly bad for that group. It's too premature to say something about how somebody should be managed. I think this is an area where we certainly need other therapies in development. This is likely a group that has is less likely to have DLL3 expression within their tumors. There's still a lot we need to learn about the subtypes, and I would caution against any clinical decision-making for a patient based upon what right now is intriguing data, but data we need to build upon. But within that, we do have an investigator-initiated study here of a SMARCA4-2 inhibitor specifically for PAL2F3 subtype. Now, if that pans out, then potentially that would become something that might be clinically meaningful. We have so much more work to do within this. The subtypes that have been defined are very intriguing, and I'm very hopeful that we will find ways to better categorize which drugs are going to work better for which individuals based upon some of the subtyping, but there's a lot more work to do still in that space.
And one more tarlatamab one for you here. Real-world data have consistently shown higher rates of CRS and ICANS with the agent than what was reported in the Delphi trials. And a multi-institution analysis that you participated in captured patients who largely would not have qualified for those trials. What do you think is driving that toxicity gap, and how has your clinical practice evolved in terms of monitoring and managing these toxicities?
We have seen a bit more CRS and ICANS than what was shown in the trials, but we are also treating some patients that are way sicker than would have qualified for the trial. Now, Alyssa Cooper led a look across Memorial Sloan Kettering and GH and Dana-Farber at a cohort of individuals treated on tarlatamab that would have not qualified for any of the clinical trials. And we are seeing a little bit more CRS and ICANS within an all-comer population, especially when including the cohort that would not have qualified for clinical trials. And Alyssa Cooper led a group experience. So patients from Memorial Sloan Kettering, MGH, and Dana-Farber, when looking specifically at those that would not have qualified for clinical trials. And we do see a bit more CRS. We also see a bit less response rate within that group of individuals as compared to individuals that would have qualified for the trial, let alone the actual trial data itself. But I think it's important to highlight that we are still seeing responses. And I have patients right now that are more than a year from when they were in pretty bad shape, poor functional status, in some cases ECOG-3 functional status, some of these with extensive brain mets, leptomeningeal disease that had previously been radiated and not eligible to get more radiation. And in some cases, their oncologist told them there are no other treatment options and hospice is the only option. Or patients that I had that had multiple lines of therapy and tarlatamab got FDA approved right when they really had nothing left and putting these patients on tarlatamab. And I have multiple of these examples of individuals that are more than a year in and clinically doing very well. So yes, we are seeing more CRS, at least in our experience, in this population of individuals, but there are often more comorbidities, their volume of disease is much more, they're more symptomatic from their small cell lung cancer as well. And I've been willing to treat patients with very poor performance status if it's from their small cell lung cancer with tarlatamab, and certainly individuals that I would not have felt comfortable treating with a cytotoxic that I'll put on tarlatamab, because the risk-benefit balance is so different. We have patients where there may be a durability that goes well beyond what we're seeing with the cytotoxics in numbers. And also, once you get past those initial couple doses and the possibility of CRS, aside from that, the toxicity profile is not as much as if you have a cytotoxic where you're getting cytopenias or fatigue that can kind of start stacking on itself. And so for an individual with a poor performance status already and some weakness, just getting past those first couple doses of tarlatamab and then being able to get their strength back. And now some of these patients walking into clinic consistently to be seen. So the risk-benefit balance is much different. Yes, more CRS, but I just have to highlight that although we are seeing a bit more CRS and a bit more complexity sometimes in the CRS in patients with comorbidities and stuff that wouldn't have qualified for the trials, we are also seeing some patients that get really miraculous outcomes and great durability to quality of life that that had we not offered it, really didn't have an option as well.
AZD2811 represents a different approach to relapse disease through Aurora kinase B inhibition, and the biomarker analysis in the phase one study was central to understanding who might benefit. What were the most compelling biomarker signals you observed here, and how do you envision those findings shaping the design of future trials in the space?
The study with AZD2811 is an interesting one. So it's an Aurora kinase inhibitor. Unfortunately, didn't see a lot of efficacy signal from this. I think something interesting to pull out of it is the correlates looking at cell-free DNA and CTCs. Now, there are other studies that show similar outcomes in that the more that we see in cell-free DNA and CTCs, the worse prognosis. And also an early signal for progression being an increase in cell-free DNA as well. There hasn't yet really been a demonstration for real clinical use of these, but we do see this correlation with progression in increasing cell-free DNA, and it's something that I think is very important to incorporate into clinical trials. And I am hopeful that we will be able to really define how this can be used in clinical practice in a way that'll lead to more monitoring. Now, certainly in the curative setting, things like MRD and cell-free DNA testing, I think will likely have a place, especially in small cell lung cancer where there's so much shed, there's more likelihood of being able to detect something in blood-based testing. And so some work to do, but it's taken us longer than I anticipated to really find proven clinical use beyond correlation with what we see in scans, but I do anticipate that we will get to a point where this becomes a part of standard practice.
As a panel member here, what would you say are the most meaningful updates in version 2 of 2026 of the NCCN guidelines for small cell, and where does the panel see the most urgent gaps that still need to be addressed in future iterations of the guidelines?
The NCCN guidelines for small cell lung cancer have recently undergone some evolution. For years, we had the second line setting was based upon chemotherapy free interval greater than 6 months, less than 6 months. In the greater than 6 months, there was a recommendation for platinum based retreatment. There were various drugs on there that in the recent years we cleaned up. But now the big change is that in the second line setting, there's no longer this greater than or less than 6 month split. It is now just across the board. Tarlatamab is the category one recommendation for second line therapy, no matter what the chemotherapy free interval was. And this is based upon Delphi 304, randomized trial of tarlatamab versus chemotherapy. This is the only positive randomized trial with a therapeutic control arm. And so this cannot be overstated how big that was as a trial showing superiority in progression-free survival, overall survival, toxicity profile, as well as symptom improvement from the disease. So this is a big deal, and the NCCN guidelines now reflect that with tarlatamab as being the second line standard of care. There are some other things within there, some minor things I'd say, but there's now a call out to keep in mind a LEMS diagnosis. This is a neurologic paraneoplastic syndrome that really causes symptoms that are quite common. And so symptoms that we really need to be aware of to ask patients more about if there's a LEMS diagnosis, recommendation is to refer to neurology for management. But there is treatment for LEMS, and these patients often do have longer term, more durable and better outcomes in small cell lung cancer as well, but important to manage their LEMS. And so this is also a diagnosis to be aware of. And so just a call out to keep that in mind with symptoms. Now, there are various paraneoplastic syndrome. There are various paraneoplastic syndromes that are listed as well to keep in mind, but that is one recent change as well.
Across all your recent work, kind of the theme of small cell not being just one disease kind of emerges. It's multiple diseases defined by transcription factor identity. Yet we largely still treat it as kind of one disease. How far away are we from truly subtype-directed therapy becoming the standard of care here?
There are multiple studies showing differences in the way that the tumors are behaving based upon different subtyping. And I think that's exciting to see. It raises the realistic potential that we will be able to better categorize which therapies might be better for different tumors, as opposed to just broadly treating small cell lung cancer the same. Now, at the same time, we're not there yet. And so I would caution against making treatment decisions based upon subtyping. But this is very, very important to continue in clinical trials. It's important that we have trials like PRISM, which is through SWOG. Ann Chang from Yale is leading that. It's a first-line maintenance study based upon subtyping. We had a prior SWOG trial by Dr. Nagla that included a PARP inhibitor with a subtype defined by Schlafen 11 in the maintenance setting of small cell lung cancer that demonstrated that this is feasible. We can do biomarker-driven studies. Certainly within the maintenance setting of first line, there's the best opportunity for that. And I'm hopeful that we will find ways of within some of these studies that some of them will demonstrate certain therapies that are working better for certain subtypes. We're not there yet, but this is ongoing and important work. As to my involvement, I mean, I'm so grateful to get to work with Matt Friedman and Matt Oser, who are doing some of this work in their lab, with Matt Friedman doing blood-based testing and Matt Oser doing quite a bit of work within his lab as well, and being able to correlate these together. It's been very fun to collaborate with them.
For the oncologists who are treating small cell in the community setting who may not have access to molecular profiling or clinical trials, what is the most important thing you'd want them to take away from your recent work here?
For the oncologists in the community, I think one, the biggest thing is to just be aware that there is a ton happening in clinical trials. There are more drugs that I think are promising, that are exciting for improving outcomes. There are more of these drugs currently in development in clinical trials than there are in existence up to this point for small cell lung cancer. The academic work within small cell lung cancer is very exciting. It's never exciting to need these drugs. I wish no one got small cell lung cancer, but for those that have it, they do have some options that really look impressive. And so a clinical trial option is an important consideration for patients, not just for future patients and not to generate data, but actually for them, it may be the best option. And so being seen within one of the centers that has multiple trials for small cell lung cancer is important. We're enrolling patients on a CAR T study for small cell lung cancer. And so there's an opportunity of getting one big treatment and then having some durability to that. That's still early in the process. And there are others, whether that be other CAR T drugs, other T cell engager drugs, other immunotherapy regimens, radioligand therapies, antibody drug conjugates. There are multiple different classes of drugs that are offering options for patients that thus far have shown really impressive response rates, some of which may end up even moving into the frontline setting. So these drugs, I think many of these are coming and will ultimately end up being FDA-approved therapies. And so patients have an opportunity to get a drug of the future today. Now, there are obviously no guarantees to that, but what we're seeing is really impressive and promising. As to some of the other work, the biospecimen work and some of the correlative work, you know, these are things that really don't matter yet in the clinical management of patients, but may help to define new paradigms going forward.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back throughout the week for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit OncLive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X and Blue Sky, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thank you again for listening to OncLive On Air.